Good day and welcome to Red Eyes Radio. Thank you for tuning in. It's good to have you with us as we continue to explore further and go deeper into the mysteries of this world and beyond. Take a good look around on our site for much more of the things that we find interesting and of importance, of course. Laird Scranton is the author of The Science of the Dogon, Decoding the African Mystery Tradition, and also Sacred Symbols of the Dogon, the Key to Advanced Science in the Ancient Egyptian Hieroglyphics. He's also got a new book coming out now in October called The Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol, From the Dogon to the Ancient Egyptian, to India, Tibet and China. And Laird has done extensive research on the intriguing Dogon people of Africa, their symbols, myths, mysterious origins and knowledge. And he joins us here today on the program to discuss some of these things. If you've never heard about the Dogon before, this is going to be a really exciting program for sure, so do stay with us. If there's any websites here that you'd like to check out, the best way, or best place rather, to go is either to Amazon.com or the publisher InnerTraditions.com to find more information about Laird's book, but we will have them linked up on Red Eyes Creations. .com as well. But with that, welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Laird. We're very pleased to have you with us here today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
Laird, why don't you briefly just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in terms of some of the things that you've been researching now for quite a few years here. How did you get involved in the Dogon, Laird?
Yes, I'm a software designer by profession. And I stumbled upon the Dogon quite by accident, reading for pleasure. My wife had provided me with a book called Unexplained by Jerome Clark. And each chapter of that book refers to some unexplained mystery in the world. And one of those chapters was devoted to the Dogon, who seemed to know some things about astronomy that they shouldn't be able to know without technological equipment like telescopes. And so I was intrigued by that fact and started to research about them. I read a book by Robert Temple called The Serious Mystery and then started following his sources, which took me to anthropological studies of the Dogon and so forth. And I've been studying the Dogon and related cultures for about 15 years now. I discovered that the Dogon are really represent a kind of crossroads between a number of different ancient traditions. The Dogon are really a modern-day African tribe. They still exist. They represent about 300,000 individuals who live in Mali, which is an area in northwest Africa, just below Morocco. They live in a very inhospitable environment in a desert along a large escarpment of cliffs. And the Dogon are a priestly tribe, and they retain a very clear sense of their own religious tradition. And the more you study it, the more you realize that the tradition touches on some very important and interesting things. For one thing, the Dogon share many things in common with Judaism. They wear skull caps and prayer shawls, and they circumcise their young. They celebrate a jubilee year like happens in Judaism. They also practice many of the same civil traditions as ancient Egypt. They observe the same calendars. They found their cities and districts in pairs called upper and lower. And their religious tradition itself shares many things in common with ancient Buddhism.
I know that there's Ethiopian Jews, what is known as Beta Israel. And do you think that there could be any relationship here between the Ethiopian people and the Dogon tribes?
Absolutely, I do. I think that there is a very ancient tradition common to both. Now, that's not to say that one necessarily came from the other, but that they both, it'd be as if you and I shared the same science teacher. And so we had many of the same references because we at various points had been taught by the same person.
Why don't we get into a little bit of who this science teacher might be? Because just as you mentioned briefly there, they have a scientific knowledge, as it seems to be the case. Astronomy, certain stars in our galaxy, as it were, that we can go into more detail later on here. But who do you think the scientists were? Where did they get their knowledge from?
Okay, well, the way to get at that question from a research standpoint is through comparative cosmology, which is really what I practice. It's as if you had three different copies of the same Shakespeare play, and you know Shakespearean plays were the copies we have were mostly written down in haste as someone listened to the play, and so the different copies are sometimes have variations one to the other. Same thing happens here. You have what looks like differing copies of an original source or text or tradition, and by comparing several different similar copies, you can extrapolate back as to what the original may have actually looked like. And so my work has been to compare the similarities and differences between the Dogon and ancient Egypt or the Dogon and Buddhism, and try to interpret which pieces were original, which pieces were added on in each culture. Mm.
Do you think that Dogon holds a kind of a more of an original teaching and more of an original formula, if you will, of these of the knowledge that existed in the ancient world?
Yes, I think they do. In my experience, what happens is that cultures that never developed a written language tend to hold on to their traditions better than those that did develop a written language. And so the Dogon appear to preserve a tradition that falls conceptually just before the emergence of writing in Egypt. There are many, many factors that suggest that they have things in common with pre-dynastic tribes and things in common with very early Egypt that make it appear that what we're looking at is a version of ancient Egypt that was very, very early. Those traditions were originally presented mnemonically. I remember watching an episode of the television comedy Cheers in which one of the characters is trying to teach the other one history, and he decides to do it by singing it to him in the form of a song. And everyone I know who ever saw the episode picked up all of the details of the history simply through one listen to the song. Well, the tradition of the Dogon is all laid out mnemonically, the same way Buddhism is originally laid out mnemonically. And so an initiate who can remember how to perform certain acts can automatically recreate details of their mythological or cosmological tradition.
Hmm. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. And in that sense, then, they seem to have a lot of in common with some of the Northern European, like the Celts and the Druids and what have you. The Oxlo had a strong, bardic tradition, things like that, that they preserve the knowledge through through song and music, basically.
Yes, and so far, virtually in every region that I have looked, you can find evidence of the same tradition. As a matter of fact, what my third book attempts to do is to lay out what I call the signature attributes of the parent tradition, and then uses those attributes to predict what we will find in a little priestly tribe in China and Tibet that I had never studied before. And so my plan was to use that parent cosmology as a kind of a pattern to predict in various regions around the world what we ought to find if they had been part of the same tradition.
What does that say then to you, that these stories and traditions are so similar around the world? Does that imply of a teacher who went around the world and spread it to different cultures, or does it just simply say to you that these tribes in some way were in communication or in contact? What do you suggest?
Well, if you go far enough back in the tradition in any single culture, you'll find references that claim that they were specifically taught this cosmological tradition as part of a civilizing plan. And the idea was that as they learned the elements of the cosmology, each phase of it was associated with a civilizing skill, such as the ability to weave a cloth or to plow a field or to plan an agriculture. And culture after culture, if you go back far enough, they all eventually say that, yes, we were taught to be civilized by someone. Many times that someone is originally revered in the tradition, and then later on, somewhere in the middle of the, I would say the 1500 BC, the teacher becomes vilified, and the tradition becomes vilified.
Why is that, do you think?
It looks to me as if the group that originally arranged the civilizing tradition had done so in delegation from another, from a larger group, and they had been forbidden from giving us deep science, and that at a later point, whoever delegated them realized that they had based the tradition on science. Imagine if you have a child who's 2 years old and they are asking pertinent questions about where babies come from. Mm. Now, you might not want to tell them as a parent the full story of where babies come from, but whatever little story you do make up to tell them, and a thinking parent will base that on real fact. You won't just tell them an outright lie. Most parents won't say, well, the stork brings a baby.
Right.
They'll say there's an aspect of the father that comes together with an aspect of the mother and creates the baby.
Kind of a metaphor a veiled story.
Right, and so it looks to me as if these original teachers decided that if they were going to provide us with a creation tradition, that it didn't make sense not to base it on real science, even though they had been told not to base it on science. And so they came up with the idea of the esoteric tradition. Tradition in the Dogon, the way that it plays out with the Dogon is that any tribe's person can learn the innermost details of the tradition if they want to, but the student has to pursue it. And the rule is that if I, as an individual, ask a Dogon priest a leading question about the cosmology, as long as the priest agrees that my question is in keeping with my status as an initiate, they have to answer truthfully.
Hmm.
But if the question is out of order with my, you know, if I'm a beginning initiate and I'm asking a very question. So we were talking about the esoteric tradition.
Yes.
And how the way it is designed would tend to prevent a stranger who came upon the scene from ever discovering any of the innermost details of that tradition. You really need to study it for a very long period of time before you learn the details. So my sense is that the tradition was originally based on science, and it very carefully based on science. It's a very interesting structure that a single set of symbols, a single set of mythological themes are used to simultaneously describe creation in terms of the formation of matter and the formation of the universe and the progression, biological progression as a child is born,
mm-hmm.
how an egg proceeds to become a baby. So now the exciting thing about the Dogon is that they've retained a very clear sense of what each symbol means and of what each word means. As a matter of fact, they place a very high value on purity of language. One odd thing about the Dogon is that if you look at them as a whole, their culture as a whole, their language is made up of 15 or 20 sub-languages. And there's that may have been borrowed from other cultures, but the sub-language or the group of words that pertain to cosmology all seem to be ancient Egyptian words.
Really?
The way that we know that is that each word carries at least two levels of definition, and these definitions are what I call, there's a logical disconnect between the definitions such that you can't guess the second one by knowing the first one. I'll give you an example that the creator god of the Dogon is named Amma, and he's a likely counterpart to Amen in Egypt. And the name means hidden god, but it also can mean to grasp, to hold firm, or to establish. So I was reading an online article one time where an author was was stating that the Hebrew word amen could not be related to the Egyptian word amen. You know, the Hebrew amen that comes at the end of a prayer could not be related to the Egyptian god amen, because the Hebrew word came from a root that means to establish. So I thought that was funny, because the author clearly didn't understand that there are two levels of meaning here, and he just invalidated his own point by making it.
So, but this is interesting, because that means then in some cases that maybe, because you mentioned the connection here with Jewish traditions and maybe stories as well, does that mean that we have a similar creation story from the Dagon as we can find in Genesis? Is that what you're saying as well here?
Yes, except that the Genesis story seems to be a very watered-down version that I associate with whatever group tried to disavow the original teaching, not associated with the group that originally taught.
Mm.
And what you find is that around 1500 BC, symbols and characters that originally were very carefully designed to carry a particular meaning suddenly all get changed. Letters get turned upside down or are changed in form. Glyphs and characters change so that they no longer retain the meaning that they originally had. They get disconnected from their original meanings.
And do you think that was a conscious plan to kind of confuse things, or why did that happen?
Well, if you recall the story of Adam and Eve and the serpent, the serpent is the creature that's associated with the ancient teachers in culture after culture. If you go back far enough, you always have the image of a serpent associated with these teachers.
Yeah.
Now, from the modern perspective, the transgression that the serpent committed was to have provided a level of knowledge he wasn't supposed to have provided. That Eve's mistake was that she encouraged Adam to partake of that knowledge.
Mm.
There are stories like that around the world where the priests who are knowledgeable see a turning point having happened where the original tradition gets deliberately circumvented.
Yeah. Distorted in a way.
Right.
So, it's incredibly interesting, and in terms of the Dagon, would you say that that's more closer to an original and correct interpretation or even scientific explanation for the creation of even the universe and life on this planet? Does it go into depths, so to speak, in terms of where we come from and how we came about to be, for instance, human beings?
Yes, the Dagon priests say that one purpose of their cosmology is to explain how their tribal god created matter. And they start with discussions of a structure that's very similar to an atom. And they say that it's composed of structures that are very similar to electrons, protons, and neutrons. And when I got that far in my studies, and I didn't know very much about astrophysics, but I knew that they had these two definitions right, the definition of the atom and of the components of the atom. And so I asked myself, what are the chances that they also have the remainder of the structure right as you descend down from there? And I began to educate myself with popular texts on astrophysics written by Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene and people like that. And what I found was agreement with the Dagon point by point, both in descriptions and in drawings or scientific diagrams, all the way down to matter in its original wave-like form at the very conceptual bottom of matter.
That's just incredible. And do you think that the Dagon have the higher priests within the society full understanding of the implications, so to speak, of this knowledge, what it actually means, or do you think that the Dagon has served more as the keepers of this knowledge, and maybe not the everyday person among the Dagon people understands this kind of the scientific level of the knowledge, or how do you explain that, Laird?
I would say that the Dagon priests know very clearly that the information they have is correct and important, Now, whether they have the knowledge or the background to be able to correlate that to the science that aligns with it, I don't know. I can't say that they do.
Yeah.
But they know for certain that the structures that they're preserving and the definitions they are preserving are very, very important because they are correct.
Fascinating. Yeah. How have you gone about researching some of this material? Have you gone down there yourself? Have you spent a lot of time in the library? Have you talked with some of the people themselves?
No, really my main tool for understanding it has been research into the anthropological studies and then comparison to other cultures that have similar traditions. The problem is if I were to go to Dogon country and ask to speak to a Dogon priest, the Dogon priest would see me as an interloper. I would ask a question and the Dogon priest would say, your background doesn't warrant you asking this question, and wouldn't talk to me. And so since your average Dogon tribes person knows nothing or not very much about the inner secrets, I could easily go there. I compare it to a parent visiting a college campus on parents' weekend and coming away with the impression that there's no evidence of drug or alcohol use. So the Dogon were actually restudied. They were originally studied in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s by a pair of French anthropologists, Marcel Griol and Germaine Dieterlin, and then later restudied, which in anthropology, it's not unusual for some aspect of an anthropologist's work to get restudied, but it's highly unusual to have an anthropologist's entire life work restudied. Well, in the 1980s, a team of anthropologists led by Walter van Beek, who's a Belgian, restudied Griol's Dogon cosmology and concluded that the Dogon priests had simply fabricated a cosmology to satisfy Griol's questions.
Oh, God. That's interesting.
And so now how do you disprove that?
Yeah.
Well, the way you disprove it is I have a daughter who visited in India for a few weeks. She was working with the Himalayan Health Exchange. And she came back and reported to me that she had seen ritual shrines all over India that reminded her of a shrine the Dogon build called a granary. And so we called up some photographs on the internet and could see that there were outward similarities. And I proposed to her, well, how about if I suggest five levels of symbolism, five points of symbolism that are true about the Dogon granary and see if we could show they're also true about the Buddhist stupa, which is what she was telling me about.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, every point that I predicted proved to be true about the stupa. So I bought a book called The Symbolism of the Stupa, which is written by Adrian Snodgrass, an Australian professor, an authority on Buddhist architecture and symbolism. He's from the University of West Sydney, Australia. And his book laid out a cosmology based on this demonic ritual structure that is point for point identical with what Griol laid out for the Dogon. In other words, Snodgrass's book, which was published 20 years after Griol's death, validates that what Griol reported was a coherent and known cosmological tradition.
Wow, that's really interesting. So again, we're back to this idea of comparing different stories and different mythologies, and that will lead us closer to the answer, as it were. I obviously do want to get into some of the material in terms of the understanding of the cosmos at large. And one of the main things that seems to come up when you search for Dogon and pretty early in the process of just discovering some of their stuff is the connection with Sirius, obviously. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, Laird.
Okay, the Sirius connection is hard to explain. You can find many evidences from culture to culture that the teachers of this tradition are associated with Sirius. For example, in Egypt, the word for teacher is pronounced exactly the same way as the word for Sirius. And the root word is transliterates as S-B-A-T, which I take to be the same as the word Shabbat in Judaism, which was originally seen as a day of instruction. So there's lots of reason to to associate these teachers with Sirius. But it's not until you get into an understanding of the full picture of what the cosmology is trying to tell us that you realize that Sirius, as an astronomic body, plays an extremely important role in the whole picture. Mm. It's difficult to get to. What the cosmology is trying to do, when you look at it in the broadest view, scientifically, is to define for us one of the key building blocks of matter that we can't see and correlate it to a matching building block in the macrocosm, in the universe, that by which we can tie the two realms together. In other words, you may be familiar with the phrase, as above, so below.
Yes.
Well, this is the structure. That phrase implies that what happens in the universe is fundamentally the same as what happens at the level of an atom.
Hmm. So we
and
can...
that the structure that they're trying to define for us and to correlate for us is the structure by which we can prove that to be true.
So we can look at things here on the planet, for instance, in a smaller scale in order to learn what is happening above us, so to speak, right?
No, actually the other way around, that we can take a very good look at the large structures that are above us to help us understand what's going on in the smaller realm that we can't see.
I see. And so, again, I mean, for instance, we have this idea of Sirius A and Sirius B as well. We have a double star up there, so to speak. But even the Dogon seem to have knowledge about this before we discovered that astronomically. Isn't that right?
Yes. Now, the reason that Sirius comes into play is because the Sirius star system is a binary star system. It consists of a bright star like our sun and a second dark star, a very dense dark dwarf star, that is the remnant of a supernova. And this supernova that created this the second Sirius star, which they call Sirius, which scientists call Sirius B, is the same event that created the macroscopic structure they're trying to point us to.
Mm. See, that's really, really interesting. So what does this mean to you in terms of, you know, if we look at the symbolism for a little bit as well here, we obviously have a worldwide culture which has adopted a lot of symbolism that has to do with Sirius as well. And it's been suggested here and there, obviously, that the teachers actually who gave us and the Dogon this knowledge have a relationship with Sirius and potentially that they even come from there themselves. What do you think about that?
That's absolutely a possibility. The Dogon seem to associate their teachers from Sirius, with Sirius, as if they had come from Sirius. In Buddhism, what are called the most sacred symbols are thought to have been given to us by a non-human source, according to Adrian Snodgrass. He doesn't go farther than that. He doesn't go so far as to say it was an alien source, but he does say it was a non-human source. In Egypt, there are, as I say, linguistic associations between a lot of the words of the cosmology and Sirius. So if someone came to me and said, time's up, you have to decide now, tell us what you really think, with no more research, I would guess that there was a Peace Corps effort that was promoted on our planet to try to raise us up from the level of hunter-gatherers to civilized beings about 3500 BC, and that it was a group from off the planet, probably from Sirius, that conducted that effort. And they conducted it on a global scale. So they created a single plan, which then was tailored in certain ways from region to region. The idea of the plan was that a tribesperson, when they came out of their hut in the morning, would see things in their daily environment that would automatically remind them of the things they'd been taught. And so everyday animals and structures and plants and activities would reinforce the cosmological teaching. And so to do that, if you need a symbol for a serpent, in India it might be a cobra, and in North America it might be a rattlesnake.
Right, right.
But it's the same symbol. If you need a horned animal, in one area it might be a bull, in another area it might be a ram, and another area it might be something else. So there was certain tailoring that went on to the plan to fit the region in which the plan was being taught.
That makes absolute sense, obviously. Do you think that this is also where the origins lies in terms of our astrological symbols? Have they been given to us in the same manner? I know that there's a lot of researchers out there who are looking at this from the point of view that ancient man discovered this, and we eventually became telling stories with the aid of the stars, so to speak. But we potentially might be looking at a situation where the constellations, so to speak, in their formation might have been taught to us as well then, right, Laird?
Yes. When you start with this ritual shrine, the stupa or the Dogon granary, there's very complex sets of symbolism that associate with the structure. And one of the things they're trying to do, the finished structure, as it presents in some of the cultures, is like a small pyramid, only with a round bottom, and staircases that go up the four sides. And each staircase is associated with certain animals in the animal kingdom. One of the things they're trying to accomplish is to provide us with a system for organizing zoology. And so you conceptually think of certain families of animals standing on certain stairs or certain staircases. One staircase is for insects, and one staircase is for fish. One staircase is for four-legged animals, and one is for birds. And so if you understand the symbolism of the structure, you also understand the relationship between these different families of animals and creatures. Hmm. And it's that symbolism that, in my understanding, eventually produced what we see as astrology.
Do you think that some of the knowledge have been preserved to this day? Obviously, the Dogon is still around, so we still have a tradition there, obviously. But I guess what I'm reaching at is, in the Western world primarily, we can look at things like Freemasonry, for instance, which in most cases, seem to come from a point of view where they're trying to understand their own symbols. They have a lot of Masonic scholars who are researching their own mythology, their own stories, so to try to understand them. But the serious connection here is kind of obvious to me, but maybe there's other things within Western esoteric traditions as well that echoes of this same story. Would you agree with that, Laird?
I would absolutely agree with that. I see the Masonic tradition as being an offshoot of the same system. Now, to try to understand any given symbol, you need to look for the earliest unperverted reference that you can find.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of the Dogon and Buddhism, we know for certain that Buddhism started at very least in the late centuries BC, in other words, just before the year zero, in the centuries just before that, we can trace stupas and we know Buddhism existed. Now, in the Dogon system, we imagine that it goes back earlier than that, but because the two systems match each other, we can conclude from that neither one of them can possibly have changed substantially over time, because if they had, they would no longer match.
Right.
So we know with certainty that the Buddhist system and the Dogon system were a match at about the year zero or just before.
And how far back do you go in terms of the knowledge of the Dogon then? How far back do you think the people have been around? And how you mentioned 13,500 BC. That's a date that usually comes up in a lot of this research, obviously. Do you think that at that given point, that's when they were given the knowledge, Laird?
The Dogon tradition that I'm studying seems to align best around 3500 BC. However, my friend John Anthony West is just back from Göbekli Tepe, which is a megalithic site in Turkey that is thought to be 12,000 years old. And before he left, I presented him with some papers that showed that most of the known symbolism at Göbekli Tepe ties in with the same system of cosmology I'm talking about.
Oh, now this is really interesting, because we had the main archaeologist, Klaus Schmidt, actually with us on the program here a while back, and that's going to be available on our website soon as well. And I asked him a little bit about that, some of the animals and some of the astrological aspect and things like that. And he wasn't really prone to go there. He understood the concept and agreed in that sense. But have you studied the site further, Laird? And if so, what can you say more about that?
Okay, I'll give you an example. In Egypt, there is a tradition of what's called the first time.
Zeptepi, yes.
Zeptepi. In Turkey, the word tepi, which goes along with Göbekli Tepe, carries 25 separate definitions. And many of those definitions are, as I've described, logically disconnected from each other, so you can't get to one by knowing the other. If you go to an Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, so far I've been able to verify that at least 20 of those 25 definitions also exist in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language under the root tepe or related roots. So when the Egyptians are talking about tepe, they're talking about the same concept that the Turks are talking about. Zeptepi could very well, in my opinion, refer back to Göbekli Tepe.
See, that's really, really interesting, obviously. Again, it seemed to suggest that either we had a single language also to begin with at the beginning, but I'd reckon from your point of view, you wouldn't mention that this is a language composed of letters, characters in that sense. That this is a language of symbols, wouldn't you say? It's a symbolic language.
Yes, it's a symbolic language, but there's also symbolism associated with phonetic sounds.
Ah.
And so in many cases, you can predict what the meaning of a word will be if it's old enough, based on its phonetic value.
That's really interesting. So language obviously is a big part in the clue here as well, because the words that we give to things today, do you think that they still have a root then in some of these ancient languages and the way that they pronounce them as well? Because in most cases we end up with a language which has been run through the Greek system, or it's been even Latinized or things like this, right?
Well, yes, but many of the words still hold up remarkably well. I mean, studying Egyptian hieroglyphic language, I come to a much better of an understanding of where many ancient Hebrew words came from, but very often I'll come across roots that make sense in terms of modern languages also.
I've heard suggested that there is a relationship, obviously, between the Hebrew letters and Egyptian hieroglyphics, that the Egyptians also had a writing language in terms of more mundane detailing of things, and I've heard that it's been suggested that Hebrew was this language. Have you been able to find any evidence for something like that, Laird?
Yes, let me try to put this into a coherent form. It looks to me that the cosmology existed before writing. There's evidence among the pre-dynastic tribes that they worshipped many of the same gods and goddesses, and that they knew about many of the same ritual shapes. Now, in the cosmology, as the cosmology plays out in Buddhism and in the Dogon culture, as you build a stupa or as you build a Dogon granary, you are evoking a series of geometric shapes, and each shape is associated with certain concepts. And the shapes and the concepts match between Buddhism and Dogonism. Now you go to Egyptian hieroglyphic language and you see that some of these same shapes play out as characters in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, carrying the same meaning, the same traditional meaning, as is known in Buddhism and among the Dogon. And my conclusion from that, my tentative conclusion from that, is that these pre-existing shapes that were associated with concepts were adopted as written characters.
Ah, I see.
That idea is supported in China and Tibet by a little tribe called the Na Ki, who have the world. They preserve the world's last surviving hieroglyphic language, and it's known for certain that the language was originally developed to express concepts of cosmology, and they use many of the same symbols. And based on my knowledge of Egyptian hieroglyphs, I'm able to predict what those certain symbols are going to mean in the Chinese language, and which words are going to appear in.
It's a kind of a universal Rosetta Stone that you have discovered here in one sense then, right?
Yes, but it's the comparisons that where the value are, and the comparisons depend on a recognition of the fact that these different systems fundamentally match. They came from something that was the same. Now, from the standpoint of many researchers, the reason we have pyramids in Egypt and pyramids in South America is because of something, a tendency of societies when they reach a certain stage and have the same materials to work with, that they develop similar forms. Mm. They're saying there's no system here. It's just natural that if you have stone to work with, you're going to create stone blocks and eventually you're going to stack them up in the form of a pyramid. And my answer to that is that's true. However, in Egypt and in South America, you have very complicated symbolism associated with a pile of stones that matches.
Yeah.
For example, the four faces of the pyramids relate to the same four constellations, and those constellations were used to control the agricultural cycle. Now, there's nothing about stacking stones that would compel that to happen. And so it's a symbolism that demonstrates for us that there must have been a common system here. Otherwise, it's not credible that both cultures would have come up with the same symbolism for the same form.
Some of the architecture, if we look at that of the Dogon people, is it's very interesting, and it's in its own way unique. It has obviously again its similarities there, but for instance, we can even look at the Dogon granary that you mentioned a couple of times now. In that sense, and that to me looks like similarities even to Egyptian obelisk. Actually, what can you say about that, Laird?
Yes. That's true. The symbolism is very complicated because it has many different facets and levels. And whoever put the cosmological plan or the civilizing plan together provided us with certain reference points to guide ourselves by so that we know when we see a given shape or a given symbol, which aspect of the cosmology is being spoken about. Mm. Now, for example, you're familiar with the progression water, fire, wind, and earth.
Sure, the elements, yeah.
Now, within the cosmology, there are many different four-stage progressions here, and there's a reason for there being four-stage progressions, but many different four-stage progressions that are presented in different ways to give us a point of reference as to where we are in a creative process. For one of these, for the Dogon, is a series of animal forms going again from insects to fish to four-legged animals to birds. Now, based on that progression, we can predict that in Egypt, the god or goddess who's associated with the very first stage of creation, the god who is associated with non-existence coming into existence, will be an insect. Mm. And in Egypt, it's Kepper, the dung beetle. We also know that we can predict that the god or goddess who's associated with the final stage of creation, which is expressed in terms of the formation of a word, in Egypt, that's the god Thoth, who happens to be bird-headed. And so by seeing the head of the animal on the Egyptian god, we can ask ourselves, what type of animal is this, and place his or her mythological role or role in creation at the proper spot along the continuum of these four steps.
I see.
Now, they've done this over and over again, and they said one involves four stages of development of a goose from an egg, and another one involves four stages of the growth of a plant. And so as you go along and you see a given reference or a textual statement, and they mention one of these key references, not only do you know which theme of the cosmology are they talking about, because each of these four-stage progressions relates to a theme, but you also know where in that theme you are. Mm. So if you come to Anubis, who is a dog, or is there's a jackal character, the jackal who is the symbol of disorder, you know based on our animal progressions that that's got to be the third stage, the four-legged animal stage, of the creative process.
That's interesting. So we can see correlations here again between the Egyptian system and things like that. And I know that Robert Bouval right now is writing about the people of Nabda Playa as one thing, and then we have the Dogon up in northwest of Africa. Do you think that they could be in some way have been responsible in terms of the Egyptian high culture in that sense, but then eventually retreated back to their own region, so to speak, or have they met? Do you think that they've kept to themselves pretty much in the area where they're at right now?
It is possible that the Dogon are related to Nabda Playa. The Dogon say that their memory, their cultural memory, is that they came from a very large lake far to the east. And so it's possible that they came from Nabda Playa. However, around 3500 BC, it was a fairly common occurrence for little priestly groups to deliberately either be sent out or choose to go out and relocate themselves away from the main group. It's the function is about like, I compare it to making a backup copy of something important to you on your computer. Mm. These groups were sent out, charged with finding an inhospitable environment, someplace out of the ordinary, out of the way, where they could live and not be interfered with, and where the tradition that they practiced had the best opportunity to be preserved. And so the Dogon have done this. They located themselves in a spot that is very, very difficult to get to. The Naqi in China and Tibet live on the border of Tibet and China in an extremely inhospitable location. Even the Hopi Indians do the same thing. They have a tradition of priestly groups setting out to deliberately locate themselves in an inhospitable place.
And again, this has to do with the preservation of their culture and the way of life then, because to me that also implies that they knew that there was going to be a lot of other people, you know, so to speak, coming on the planet and potentially threatening.
Well, yes. Well, they knew that the natural progression of a society is going to eventually dilute a religious tradition.
Yeah. So all these different people you mentioned, Naqi, Hopi, we're talking about the Dogon, and eventually, way back we had the Egyptians as well. What do you see in any regard that these the knowledge that these people carry are going to be widely dispersed again, into the main culture of the planet, so to speak, in that sense, or do you see that things are it's being more and more diluted all the time? What do you think, Laird?
It's a little of both. There are forces working in both directions. I can see that from a scientific standpoint, this cosmology includes information that our scientists are just on the cusp of discovering, or there are still a few hints and clues available in the cosmology that could save us effort. I think the original idea was that as we progressed as civilized beings, that after a few hundred or a few thousand years, we would notice that our religious tradition was really a mirror of the scientific tradition. Back in that day, religion and science were the same thing. But then we would recognize that there were commonalities here, and then we would have to do is follow the religion to find the clue to the next scientific piece we were looking for.
Hmm. No,
and somewhere along the line, we lost that. But that never really happened. We got sidetracked, and just now, as we're noticing that these things are the same, there's still the possibility. For example, scientists are trying to decide among 200,000 possible shapes what the Kalabiyau space looks like. This is a structure way down deep in matter that it's a bundle of wrapped up dimensions that's at every point and thought to be at every point in space and time. Mm-hmm. They're trying to sort out what could this look like. Well, the Dogon have a drawing of it. The scientists are trying to figure out how many fundamental particles they are. They know there are more than 200.
Yeah.
The Dogon say there are 266.
Huh.
So there are clues here that could be very, very important to scientists still. And The hope is that they will be before science catches up with what the religion can do for us.
Well, Laird, I definitely want to talk more about the scientific aspects to this in our next segment. There's much more to discuss, obviously. We just begin to scrape the surface here in terms of the science of the Dogon. But I want you to mention your titles again for us, Laird, so people who want to study more on the Dogon and research for themselves the material that you brought forward, what the titles are and basically where we can go to pick up copies of the books as well, Laird.
Okay, the first book is called The Science of the Dogon. It's a republishing of an on-demand book that I self-published called Hidden Meanings. The second book is called Sacred Symbols of the Dogon, and it's more involved with questions of how Dogon symbols relate to Egyptian culture and Egyptian writing. The third book, which is due in October, is called The Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol. And it's involved more with understanding what the parent cosmology must have looked like based on the other cultures that we're comparing.
All right.
The books are available in Barnes & Noble bookstores on the shelf. You can also find them inexpensively at buy.com or amazon.com. And you can find them at the publisher's website, which is innertraditions.com.
All right, excellent. We will have these linked up on Red Eyes Creations as well from Amazon.